I'm Lauren Letellier.
I'm Chris Atkins. We're volunteers at the Rojan Library.
And this is WGXC, Acre, Hudson, and Catskill.
Tune in WGXC's new Sunday morning schedule with the Reverend Kim Singletary and There's a Bright Side Somewhere every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. That's followed by the teens from Hudson talking about books they've read on Bound by Books. After the local news at 9 a.m. And at 10 a.m., there's more teens. The Catskill kids from Clubhouse Radio are on at 10 a.m. with lots of music and talk on your community radio station, WGXC.org, 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable. All the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are listening live to Tech Talk with Bill and Ralph, or Ralph and Bill, depending on how you want to say it. We're on WGXC 90.7 FM out of Accra. Good evening, Mr. Ralph.
Good evening, Mr. Bill. Oh, no, Mr. Bill!
That is not how you say, oh, no, it's Mr. Bill! Okay.
Oh. Okay, got it.
I have it down.
You, as Mr. Bill, should know best.
Right. And the radio audience cannot see me that I am Shakoing it up today. I'm wearing an actual Shako. It's just a kind of hat that most of the band hats are Shako hats. I collect hats. So I'm Shakoing it up today with my update on my favorite app and other app updates today. And we have callers coming in. Ralph, can you give the caller numbers? Do you have them?
Oh, do I have to do everything around here? Okay.
At least.
Yeah. Let's see. WGXC would be 518-622-2598. Hello, world.
Yes, if you're listening and you're in the radio audience, if you call in tonight, Ralph will send you a gold bar.
Gold brick, and his name is Bill Collier.
I'm a gold bricker. Wendy from New Rochelle is on the line.
Oh, great. Wendy from New Rochelle, do you have a question for us?
Yes, I do. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Okay, my question is, do you think the Calm.com meditation app is worth the cost?
That's a really good question. So let's dial it back a little bit for our less sophisticated listeners, and that is, there is an app which you can download onto your iPhone, maybe you can even download it onto your primitive Android, that helps you achieve mindfulness and calmness and serenity, and it's called Calm, CALM.com. And it has recently raised money that implies that the valuation of this ephemeral little thing is worth $1 billion. So people invested hundreds of millions of dollars into helping build out this app so that you can go download it from the App Store, whether it's the Apple Store, whether it's the Google Store. And then you can pay $5 a month to have this kind of little smorgasbord of meditation techniques that will allow you to pause during the day and to center yourself and achieve calmness. And apparently there is an, I, I am not a subscriber to Calm.com. But from what I've read, there's an entire litany of little brain hacks and meditations and things you can listen to that will help you achieve calmness, which is why I suppose they named it Calm.com. Bill, are you familiar with this, or are you just...
I am familiar with it, and my answer to the question is really whether or not you get a lot out of the app is really up to you. I've had friends that I've used it and love it. I tried it and wasn't a huge fan. So I really guess
That's because you have already achieved total serenity.
I am Mr. Zen.
Enlightenment, right? Yes.
I am Mr. Zen.
Right. Bill Zen, we call him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Wendy from New Rochelle, the question is, first of all, is the benefit that is offering you calmness, serenity, mindfulness, something that you feel like you would value if you had it? So let's start by not how you get there, but what you're trying to get. Some people want it. Some people crave excitement. Some people crave stimulation. Some people crave thrills. This is kind of the opposite. This is feelings of security, calmness, and serenity. Does that appeal to you as something that you would like to have more of in your life? Let's start there, maybe from you, Rochelle.
It appeals to me very much.
Okay, so the next question is does it work? And my guess is it's just like everything else. It works. It works for some people if they actually use it. And for some people, it doesn't work. But if it happens to the techniques, the brain hacks it has don't actually work for you if you use it on a consistent basis, then you can discontinue the subscription and you haven't wasted a lot of money trying it out. That said, it's a huge success with millions of people who have downloaded it, which provides social proof that implies that it's pretty effective for the majority of people. Maybe not everybody, but maybe you.
Yeah, so, they must like it or they wouldn't be using it. What I find is interesting is that it's an app. So it's technology that's basically feeding you this content to help you be calm, whereas somebody may go to a therapist or somebody like that. I'm wondering what kind of impact the app would have on those who are practitioners that help people on a one-on-one basis, and if it's a sufficient replacement. In other words, they may be happy with it, they're using it, but is it really helping them as much as a personal coach or somebody like that might help them?
Well, Bill, that frames it in a kind of interesting way. That said, if I'm right, the price of Calm.com is $5 a month. But it may not replace a meditation teacher or yoga teacher, but it might be a nice complement to it. And since typically one session with a meditation teacher can easily cost $100, and this would cost less than one session, then it's not exactly comparable. So It may be that it's something that you you would want both of, as opposed to an either or kind of thing. And by the way, there are some meditations that are extremely high in, let's just say, glamour, prestige value, like transcendental meditation, of which I happen to be a trained initiator, trained by Maharishi 40 years ago. He became world famous as the Beatles guru, When I studied transcendental meditation back before you were born, when I first learned it, it was, I think, $15 for students and $35 for adults. Last time I looked, and don't hold me to this because I didn't look very carefully, I didn't look very long, it was some time ago, it now costs you $3,000 to become initiated and trained in Bija mantra meditation, which is what transcendental meditation is. And so compared to $60, it's 50 times as expensive as $60 a year versus $3,000 to be trained as a transcendental meditator. Sure makes calm.com look like a screaming bargain.
A real bargain.
Works. So,
very good.
Wendy from New Rochelle, personally, having studied things like meditation and having studied things like Qigong exercises, and having studied things like Reiki, I personally recommend hypnotism. So if there are also some hypnosis apps out there, and I think you could probably go to Google and find out, you know, what people are saying about whether calm.com, mindful apps, hypnosis apps, maybe there's even a Reiki app out there, and, you know, shop around a little bit and then try it. But just make sure that you can cancel your subscription if you're not using it or if it's not working out for you. How's that for some excellent advice on my part? You can compliment me.
Every once in a while, you give good advice, Spanko.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling, Wendy.
Rochelle, and thank you, Bill Collier, for your effusive praise, which I could get really used to. Hey, we have another caller coming in. Who might that be, Bill?
No, this is the phone call. The phone number is 518-697-7400 or 518-622-2598. If you're out there in radio land,
or World Wide Web land,
glued to the radio. I don't know how many are on the World Wide Web, but there's probably more on the radio, on the terrestrial radio. You remember terrestrial radio, don't you, Ralph?
It's got something to do with watts.
Yes. It's very...
Not in Los Angeles, not the inner city of Los Angeles.
Well, they have these really great breakfast, breakfast dish that comes from radio. It's called a Hertz Donut.
A Hertz Donut.
Yeah, I punch you in the arm and then I say it hurts, don't it?
Oh, God. that would be a joke, wouldn't it, Bill? Or at least
that was a joke. But listen, I have an update. Are you ready? I have a TikTok update, and this is the sad side.
TikTok on Tech Talk.
Here we go. TikTok on Tech Talk. So TikTok.
Let me get my box of Tic Tacs first.
Oh goodness. TikTok has been banned in India, as you know.
I didn't know.
It's banned in India. India is banning Chinese apps. Like, it's just not even gone. It's just having a good time. And now Snapchat is coming for TikTok. So they added the TikTok. They added music powered features last month. And this week they launched a dedicated place within its app where users can watch short entertaining videos in a vertically scrollable setting. So sort of like a TikTok feed. So this is called Spotlight. It is designed to give people a place to go other than TikTok. Meanwhile, India is banning like 220 apps from China. They're like, if it's Chinese, it's gone. So the app war between the Chinese and the Indians is really heating up. I don't see that it's going to end anytime soon. I'm sure that a lot of India users are using VPNs and other services to get around that, because the addiction to TikTok is great. And in the U.S., there was a federal judge who we're just not sure what's going to happen. So at any rate, we got Beth.
Bill, you're the TikToker in the family. Isn't TikTok supposed to be shut down by President Trump?
It isn't shut down yet. It's still surviving. We have Betsy from Vermont, though. Let's move on.
Well, it was just getting good.
I know, but we'll pick up TikTok. I'm sure Betsy will care about TikTok. Everybody does.
Well, I don't, and maybe Betsy will too, or won't.
No, so, Betsy, you care about TikTok, don't you, Betsy?
Well, good evening, gentlemen. I'm afraid I don't care about TikTok. I have to sit with
Hold on. I need to have a cry.
A voice of sanity. Finally.
I need to have a cry. I need to have a cry.
Have a good cry.
Yes, okay. Thank you for calling, Betsy. What is your cheerful news or question?
Well, I'm intrigued by an old friend from the internet, Wikipedia. The New Yorker did a recent article about the television show Jeopardy and about Wikipedia, and was ruminating about the availability of knowledge and whether it's worth remembering anything anymore. And that got me thinking about Wikipedia, and the article was quite informative about how it's grown tremendously over the brief decades it's been in existence, and threatens to displace a whole lot of remembering things. But I wondered if you gentlemen had any comments about that.
I personally think if one is using Wikipedia to remember, it is a real problem. It's not. I don't think it's a reliable source in general. I know Robert would agree because
Bill is wrong about this.
Right.
That's quite common. Betsy from Vermont. I read that article or a good chunk of that article in the New Yorker as well, and I was just fascinated by how fundamental Wikipedia is to the internet and our use of the internet. I make use of it on a regular basis. Wikipedia is produced by something called crowdsourcing. And so everybody can go in there and help to write or edit an article on Wikipedia as long as they adhere to the standards, which are hundreds of pages, 500 or 1,000 pages of thou shalt and thou shalt nots. But there's a whole community of Wikipedians who are, you know, it's their hobby, and they take it very seriously. And there are so many thousands of them who do it that they keep it patrolled very well. And therefore, the initial skepticism, which apparently only Bill Collier is retaining now, since this was an amateur rather than a elite professional publication like the Encyclopedia Britannica, where a bunch of PhDs and fancy pants experts were writing things, that the idea that we common people, not like Bill, he's elite, could actually get together and put together an extremely reliable and informative source of facts, canceling each other out where there are matters of dispute, has been, according to the New Yorker, which I find a very credible source, has been proved out in practice as an extremely valuable resource on the internet. Now, Bill,
my take on it,
a populist probably wants to repeal Section 230 and actually destroy the Wikipedia, but I think that that's probably an overreaction.
I don't care what Wikipedia does. It is a very biased and opinionated, especially when it comes to politics. So I don't use it. I haven't used it for a long time. I don't consider it reliable. And that's that.
Well, I guess reasonable minds can differ.
Bill. Betsy,
again, yes.
From Vermont, do you use the Wikipedia?
Oh, yes. Yes. It's. I have to take it with a grain of salt sometimes. I know I have looked people up and read things about them and then subsequently discovered that they got edited down, and I've even pitched in on a rare occasion when I actually had more facts than the obscure article had about a particular individual. I corrected it and provided citations, which I think have stuck because they were grounded in you know, published sources like acts of the legislature and so forth. I think the crowdsourcing angle on knowledge, which is kind of crowd based to begin with anyway, is a very salutary development, and I sure hope the governments don't get in there and muck it up at some point.
Well, Betsy, you're obviously a populist. Bill is obviously an elitist. And so, consequently, he is on the wrong side of history.
No, actually, I love the crowdsourcing model. I just don't like the bias and the dishonesty, that's all.
What dishonesty? You just don't like it because the Wikipedia entry on Bill Collier says that you're a serial killer. It was put up there by your progressive enemies.
What are you talking about? I put that up myself. What are you talking about?
And you are, your feelings are hurt, and our little snowflake conservative buddy Bill is really wants a safe space on the internet where he can go and where he can.
Well, that's a misreading, and that's a typical elitist response to somebody who just simply doesn't trust something.
Well, Bill, let me ask you this. What would you propose as an alternative source of information?
I'll go back to what you originally said, Betsy, about people not remembering. There are certainly times when I look at Wikipedia and I want to see what it says. I check its sources. Of course, I know how to use Google. I know how to use Bing and DuckDuckGo, so sometimes I use those sources to cross-check things. I know how to get... I have access, for instance, to newspaper archives going back for decades and decades. I subscribe to a service. Now, in this case, I'm paying, $100 a month for a service. So I'm a little bit more... I probably have access to more information than most people because I spend like $200 or $300 a month on information sources that allow me to search databases that you're not going to find on Google or on Wikipedia. I don't like the idea of people not remembering things because, I keep thinking of the Animal Farm scenario where they didn't remember the laws and they just kept changing them until it was, two legs good and four legs bad. So,
but nobody must use.
I think people need to take agency over their own information and what they assume. I don't care if people trust or don't trust Wikipedia. I certainly don't want the government involved in it, despite my opinion. My opinion is just my opinion. But I wouldn't trust anyone's words.
When we of the deep state want you to have an opinion, we will give it to you. So don't worry so much.
Wow. And there you go, Betsy. Now you know why. Now you know.
Well, I always appreciate a good airing of views. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah.
That was a great question. I appreciate
it. It was an
that.
Awesome question, as always.
I had an ironic interaction with the Wikipedia about, 10 years ago, before I was woke to it. And I wrote a book that was internationally award-winning, the Webster's Dictionary, How to Use the Web to Transform the World. And it won the Trophée du Choix des Internautes from the World E-Democracy Society in Paris and so forth and so on. And I really wanted to, I naively wanted to be in the Wikipedia. And it turned out when I did some research or asked a knowledgeable Wikipedian, it turned out that the book was notable, but I was not. So the book was eligible to have a Wikipedia entry, but I, the mere author of it, was not. I found that to be baffling. I did not spend a lot of time mastering the 500 words of regulations having to do with Wikipedia postings. I got the very basics. You're not supposed to post about yourself. You're not supposed to post original content and so forth. But boy, there was just so much to it that I eventually gave up. But then I eventually realized that I was very fortunate that there is no Wikipedia entry about me, because once there is a Wikipedia entry about you, you have to kind of patrol it to make sure that your enemies are not putting a lot of lies and slanders about you in there, because most reporters, the first place they start their research on you when they're heading down the road to write a story about you or that you're in, is they check out Wikipedia. And if you were so unfortunate enough as to have a Wikipedia entry, then you really need to keep an eye on it to make sure that someone who wishes you ill has not filled it up with misinformation. And by the way, if they have, you are forbidden from going in there and cleaning up an article about yourself.
So that means you have to go and ask favors of friends, which is not strictly kosher, but there's no way for the Wikipedia to prevent it.
And there you go. And therein lies the problem.
Well, what problem is that, Bill?
False information that just stands and can't be really refuted.
Well, I don't know, but when I was reading your Wikipedia entry about your conviction for as a serial killer and so forth and so on, all I can say is it rang true.
All right, Michael from Portland is calling, and I'm sure that he has a Wikipedia entry on him as well. Hello, Michael from Portland.
Is it Portland, Maine?
Hello, TikTok.
All right.
It is Portland, Maine.
All right. I have a question about the blockchain. From my understanding, right now it's incredibly energy intensive to mine Bitcoin, as an example, and also other cryptocurrencies. And I heard that Intel is working on creating a device that has the processing power to mine huge amounts of Bitcoin and other crypto without using a lot of energy. So I wanted to ask if using energy is one of the things that's absolutely necessary right now, how is Intel making this marvelous, amazing product?
Well, ancient Intel secret. I don't want to be totally skeptical of it, but a lot of these promises that, you know, we run across don't always pan out as suggested. Was it Intel the one that did the AI that turned out to be kind of cheating? I'm not sure if it was Intel.
I doubt that very much, Bill, because Intel makes chips, not potato chips, not corn chips.
I said AI.
Computer chips. And while an AI would live on a chip, it's probably more algorithms than it is integrated circuits. So,
I am really going to wait until Deep Think weighs in on that, if you understand what I'm saying.
No, he doesn't. And if he does, I don't. And if I don't, then...
Michael, do you know what I was referring to? Michael probably knows.
Am I referring to what?
Deep Think.
Is that any relation to Deep Think?
I don't know that term. Am I referring to what?
No. I said, I referenced and I said, we will wait until to see what Deep Think has to say about that.
Oh, the Google AI.
Not the Google AI. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the computer, Deep Think.
Did you say deep or geek?
Deep. I cannot believe you two have not.
I tried to read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I found it to be a facile, tedious farce. So, like,
well, that's a very snobby thing. We populists, we real true populists, all get it. We love it. And yes. So long and thanks for all the fish.
Yes, and I just know that
another reference from the book, by the way.
Yes, I know. And as soon as you can tear yourself away from watching reruns of the Three Stooges.
Baker, do you have a towel?
A towel?
Yes, you're. Michael, are you familiar with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I know of it, but I haven't read it, so I'm not super familiar.
So I pegged you as a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of guy. I really did. I thought you were going to be right there with me, but clearly I'm all alone. I'm just standing out ahead of the crowd, all by myself, with my towel, just waiting for the end to come.
I get it. Well,
I think you might be onto something.
I only have one thing to say to you, Collier. 42.
Exactly. That is the answer. That's the meaning of life and all that.
Right, but I'm not sure you've, I think you've successfully evaded Michael from Portland's question.
I did, I am not sure what the answer to the question is, because I'm not
The answer is obvious. Michael, the answer to your question is 42.
No. He wants to know if and how Intel's is going to create a...
it's not Intel's. Intel's is a political research firm based in Texas. Intel.
He wants to know if Intel has a...
Intel got a patent 2 years ago for a lower energy consumptive architecture to build a chip that uses less energy to mine Bitcoin
and right.
cryptocurrencies in general. 2 years is not a long time for them to spend to move from the technical specifications to actually building the chip. That said, the market for ASICs, application-specific integrated circuits to mine Bitcoin, is probably very modest compared to the stuff that Intel sell lots and lots of chips for. So it would not surprise me if they actually never built their Bitcoin mining chip.
I think that's actually a brilliant answer. I'm going to have to give you a hand clap for that one.
Bring it on. So, Michael from Portland, does that cast a little light on your question?
Yeah, it did. I don't think I still understand the mechanism of how they would make it cheaper, but I guess it has something to do with processing power.
Well, they do it by miniaturizing the circuits, and I was just reading an article last week about the first trillion circuit computer chip. It's more than a trillion circuits on the computer chip. It's a large, plate-sized computer chip rather than a tiny little thumbnail-sized computer chip. But what they've done by miniaturizing circuits is really kind of amazing. But if I could just say this one thing about Bitcoin, what's called mining, but I actually think it's more in my book on the subject, the Redefining the Future of the Economy, Governance Blocks, and Economic Architecture. My co-author, Dawn Talbot, and I say it's more like minting than mining. That said, the amount of energy that's used to mine or mint cryptocurrencies sounds like a lot, but it's relatively trivial compared to the amount of money that is used to mine and mint, for instance, coins. And so for all of the angst that has to do with the fact that all of the cryptocurrency mining in the world uses up about as much energy every year as Ireland or Switzerland or something like that, is not really a whole lot of energy in the grand scope of things. And so even though it's, more than trivial, it's also not existential. And so do we want a application-specific integrated circuit that will allow people to mint or mine cryptocurrency that's less energy intensive? Sure, because energy costs money. And by using less energy, you can create these cryptocurrencies more economically, and that's always a good thing. But it's also not like, it's also not like a major macroeconomic driver in the cryptocurrency ecosystem. So does that address your question any better?
Yes, it does. And thank you.
Awesome. Well,
thank you for calling in.
It's clear that Ralph is.
All right. Talk.
I'm on fire tonight.
En fuego.
Yeah. Well, mid-Hudson, Upper Hudson Valley, and hello world. Here we are at Tech Talk on WGXC.
Both lines are open, 518.
597-7400.
518-622-2598. We are waiting for the next call.
Well, we're not waiting.
In our effort to play stump the Bill Collier.
Okay, so here's some news. Apple's App Store Connect will now require an Apple ID with two-step verification enabled. More the Apple prison has closed ever more doors or venues of escape. Apple announces a holiday schedule for the App Store Connect. New apps and app updates won't be accepted between December 31st and December 27th. So your TikTok on Apple will not be updated, and that's sad. I know that you care. Apple rounded up developer praise for its App Store commission change, lending their names to Apple's list, Little 10 Robot, a bunch of different companies are happy with Apple's new App Store commission change. Are you familiar with that? You probably don't.
Am I unfamiliar with it? I fail to see its relevance to me.
It's going to make it better for the app developers, ergo there will be more apps.
I think there are already, how many apps are there, Bill? I think there are already too many apps.
I don't, that's spoken like a true elitist snob, as opposed to populist who lets the market decide. I'm sure that you want the Central Planning Committee to have a five-year plan for app development, but I'll just let the market handle it. Thanks.
Well, according to Google, you've heard of it, perhaps, the App Store now has 1.96 million apps available for download.
I don't see a problem with that.
And there are 2.87 million apps available for download on the Google Play Store. So when does enough become too many?
That's a good question. Again, it's for the market to decide, not for your five-year plan.
We call that the Ghost Plan. Show some respect. It propelled the Soviet Union to, you know, heights of achievement that you capitalist running dogs can only dream about.
Oh, yes, yes. The universal poverty. They definitely achieved it.
Well, that's because you're an imperialist, capitalist, materialist pig, if I may be blunt.
By the way, TikTok has until December 4th.
Now. I know, that's what I told you.
I didn't hear you, I guess.
Well, pay attention. I've got important things to say, and I'm saying it right here on TikTok, Tech Talk on WGXC at 518-622-2598. So, Bill, I thought I would have, you know, I know you're a TikTok guy, but I would have taken you, I had to take you sight unseen, which is the best way of taking you, one can infer, that you'd be more of a Fortnite guy.
I don't do games. I suck at games, to be honest.
Really? Well, why don't you tell our listeners what Fortnite is?
I think you know more than I do, because I only know that it's a game that people play, and I don't play it.
Well, I don't play computer games either, because
I mean, it seems like you're shooting people, and you're building things, and you're jumping all over the place, all at the same time.
I did see a wonderful little vignette of my favorite member of Congress, Alexandria
Cortez,
AOC. I've elevated her to an acronym now, so now I begin to forget her name. And she was on something called Twitch, and she was a little animated creature running around and conducting fights on Twitch. And she was, this apparently her moment on Twitch, which was also designed to encourage people to go out and vote in the last election. How irresponsible is that? Went viral and was viewed by tens or hundreds of thousands of people. So it made me wonder, what am I missing with Twitch?
Well, Twitch is a whole different animal. It's a video live streaming thing that's usually for games that has been dominated by a lot of ladies who have people following them and who get as close to the line of risque to soft porn as they can. And
what?
That's
AOC went into a risque website?
No. AOC was fine. She didn't do anything.
I saw a video.
That's one of the population groups on Twitch now. I don't watch Twitch, but I watch YouTube videos making fun of people on Twitch.
Well, that seems kind of mean.
It's hilarious. And the drama between all the different actors on the personalities on Twitch, and it's fun, but I don't actually watch them. I just watch the drama about them, which I find to be amusing.
Well, all I could say is you've proved my hypothesis. Some people have way too much time on their
hands. They do. Oh, this is an evening indulgence of mine, so.
Kind of like watching TV, but without the intellectual substance of that of the Kardashians.
Well, I don't watch TV very much, so, and I never have. So I still remember the world. You know, the greatest was "Believe It or Not, I'm Walking on Earth." Never thought I could be. You remember that show from the 80s, the Greatest American Hero, or something like that?
No. I remember The Twilight Zone. I remember Leave It to Beaver. I remember Father Knows
You remember Best. Leave It to Beaver, do you?
I do. Live and in black and white.
Well, now I watched it as reruns, of course, because I was... Well, you didn't watch it live because you were... No, actually, you might have. Yeah, you're pretty old. You probably watched the silent, and then the talkies were new to you, right?
They were new, but I thought that they lacked a certain subtlety.
So Ralph, you grew up though in the early 60s.
I grew up in the late 50s, to the extent that I ever grew up, and then I did a little supplementary growing up in the 60s.
Now, here's a question for you: considering today versus then, how fundamentally different is communication now from when you were a kid? I mean, when I was young, I remember having a party line. We had two people sharing one phone. That was hilarious. And but I'm thinking when you were young, you know, the idea of calling long distance was probably like a major event that everybody saved up for.
Yeah, it was traumatic. And you would have a little 3-minute egg timer that you would flip over, that we would flip over. But remember, Bill, when I was getting my start, there were only 5 digits in a phone number. So my original phone number when I was a preteen kid was 891514.
You had a phone number of your own in your house?
Yeah. Yeah, and everybody did, but there was just 891514, and then later on, the number of telephones proliferated to the point where they had to add another digit, and then they added an area code. Oh, looks like we have another caller, Bill.
Saul from Connecticut.
Hey,
Saul from Connecticut.
Is it Shaw? I didn't see the writing correctly. So if it's Shaw from Connecticut, that's awesome.
Y'all. Hello, y'all. Shaw?
No, it says Saul from Connecticut. Thank you. Saul.
Yes, that's good.
Better call Saul.
That's it. Saul's the guy to call.
All right. Hello, Saul. You don't call Welcome. Hello, Saul. Welcome to Tech Talk with Bill and Ralph.
Well, thank you, Bill and Ralph. I just had kind of a general question as far as do you think it's inevitable that you know, that this cryptocurrency is going to be like the thing of the future? In other words, you know, everything is digitizing. Like, is it a slam dunk that it's going to happen? In your
no, it's so far until they can perfect stable coins. And by the way, I'm a founder of a stable coin company, full disclosure. The current generation of what's called cryptocurrency, which would be mainly Bitcoin or Ethereum-based currencies like Hyperledger, are definitely cryptic, but they are not currencies. They completely lack the three fundamental qualities of moneyness. And unless the stable coins come out and manage to get that fixed, which they might, whether that's Tether or Frax.finance, the one that I helped to co-found, or one of the other emerging stable coins, which maintain stability of value, everything like Bitcoin or Ether or Ripple is too volatile. It bounces around too much in value to serve as money. Money has, we've known since the 1870s, that the fundamental properties of money, what we call money, has three fundamental properties. It's a medium of exchange, it's a store of value, and it's a unit of account. And so hardly anybody actually buys anything with Bitcoin because there are too many complications to use it, or to buy anything with Ether, with Ethereum, because it's just too complicated to use. In practice, it's too expensive. With Ether, you have to pay for something called gas in order to do a transaction. So unlike buying something with cash, which is frictionless, you have something that costs you money every time you make a transaction. There are latencies or delays in the use of crypto. So for instance, if you walk into a grocery store and want to buy, if they were willing to accept Bitcoin, it might take as much as 30 minutes for you to make your Bitcoin payment and for the Bitcoin payment to transmit to the grocery store's account. You obviously don't want to stand there in the line or after the checkout line for 30 minutes waiting for your payment to clear. So far, as it exists, it's not an efficient medium of exchange. It is a bad store of value in the sense that it fluctuates. It can gain $3,000 per Bitcoin in an evening. It can lose $1,000 in an evening. And so it's not a store of value. It's a speculative asset. And it's not a unit of account. A unit of account, you know, a dollar today, assuming that inflation remains quiescent and we also don't have deflation, will buy pretty much the same amount of groceries in a grocery bag as it bought last year or will buy next year. That makes it a good unit of account. The fluctuation in the purchasing power of cryptocurrency is so volatile that it's a bad unit of account. And so currently...
All right, so I'm hearing you say that that you're kind of holding out for that stable coin. Is that what you said?
Right. Well, I wouldn't say I'm holding out for it. I'm simply saying the potential for stable coins to become valuable in commerce is very real. But cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin, Bitcoin was invented around 11 years ago. And other than it being the province of enthusiasts, cryptocurrency enthusiasts who believe passionately that it is the way of the future, it isn't used for very much because it has these structural defects. Now,
and what makes something a stable coin and Bitcoin not being a stable coin? What is it exactly?
Well, the current leading stable coin is called Tether. And in theory, for every one Tether, there's a dollar sitting in an account somewhere. So the Tether coin is defined by the fact that it has collateral. It's collateralized to actual dollars. There are some problems with this. I don't want to be too hard on Tether, but I have read articles. I can't argue that they're reliable. That say Tether is not rigorously audited, so their claim to have $1 for every Tether coin in stock is something you have to take on faith. It's not transparent, which makes some people nervous. That may not be true. That may not be fair, but that is one of the factors that you need to take into account. The other thing is that another factor about Tether is it's been hacked, and people have like popped in there and essentially stolen a bunch of Tether coins out of the accounts of their holders. Now, if memory serves me correctly, Tether turned around and undid those transactions, or made good for the hacking, for the value that got mulcted out of the system. But that also made people feel anxious, because what if that happened at a greater scale where Tether couldn't make good on the losses?
Yeah.
Okay. Now the stablecoin company that I helped found about a year ago, and that's going to launch onto mainnet. It's been in testnet this month. It's going to launch into mainnet very soon, presumably in December, which starts tomorrow. Is a fractional. It is different because it's an algorithmically determined fractional reserve stablecoin that actually allows you to earn interest on the coin. And so it's a very interesting proposition. I am not a coder. I don't code stability, and I am not. My role as senior counselor as a founder had more to do with business practices than it does with technology. But stablecoins are now the new hot thing, whether it's Frax.finance or any one of the number of emerging stablecoins. Facebook announced last year that it would be launching a stablecoin called Libra. It came under a lot of criticism, including from me, because it was to be targeted to a basket of currencies, much like the special drawing rights, which, as I wrote and as other people wrote, would have made it intrinsically unstable against the dollar. So if you had a Libra, if it was being stabilized against the basket of currencies, the euro, the pound, the dollar, the yen, that means that the value of the Libra would be fluctuating every day, every minute. So when you walked into a store and buy something with a Libra, you wouldn't know if the Libra was worth a penny more or a penny less. And that struck me, and I wrote at the time in an online magazine called Hacker Noon, that was disqualifying to make it a capable stablecoin. Whether they read my article or whether they figured out on their own, they are now creating a Libra that is targeted, stabilized to the dollar, and Libras that are stabilized to the euro, and Libras that are stabilized to other currencies. So that might help to solve that particular intrinsic problem. Libra has some other headaches. There are a bunch of regulators and central banks who they've provoked a lot of hostility toward Facebook's Libra. So we will see if they can overcome their regulatory hurdles. So
Ralph, if I can give the short answer to the question. Until cryptocurrencies are used in commerce in an easy manner, I don't think they'll ever have any danger of replacing regular currency.
Uh-huh.
That's always been my stance. Ralph has many of the great detailed reasons, and I agree with everything he said. But the bottom line is, if these currencies aren't used to buy, sell, and trade, and for all the reasons Ralph stated, they're not, a few months ago, we were at 4,000 for Bitcoin. Now it's at 19,000. That is not a way to save money. I mean, imagine I would not want to have $19,000 worth of Bitcoin today, because I'd be thinking that maybe in a year it'll be $3,000. Not very stable, and I don't want to spend it and use it.
Yeah, I hear you.
And by the way, let's flip it around and then back to Saul from Connecticut. I know a bunch of people who got very enthusiastic about Bitcoin 2 or 3 years ago when it shot up from $1,000 to $19,000 very quickly. So they poured thousands of dollars of their life savings, these are just working people, into buying Bitcoin at $19,000, only to watch it drop down to $3,000. So if they bought at the top and sold at the bottom, they lost a lot of money that they had been saving up to help buy a house or redo their kitchen or something.
Yeah, sure. Wow.
I made $5,000 during that time, by the way, so.
You made that okay.
It's a fun speculation if you could afford to lose the money, but nobody knows whether it's going to go up or down. So you have to have, and there's no intrinsic value to it at all. It is a, you know, it's a piece of code, and since the price of everything is determined by supply and demand, and since there's no utility demand for Bitcoin because it's not very useful for very much.
I hear you.
You can create a distributed ledger that is mutable so that people can't hack it, but it's a very arduous, cumbersome, expensive way to encrypt and store your data. Then if you feel like speculating, if you're a gambling man, Saul, then go for it.
I hear
you. Gamble all you can afford to lose, and I hope you hit the jackpot.
Now, I just want to ask kind of like a philosophical question, if I may. You know, I'm not techie like you guys, but to me, it hits me like this whole drive towards these other kinds of currencies, whether they're crypto, whether they're, you know, whatever they might be, Bitcoin or Ethereum or other kind of coins that you mentioned. What's driving this? Is it the idea that for a long time we've sort of been spoon-fed or shoved? It's been shoved down our approach that, you know, globalism, that there's this, you know, inevitability of globalism, and it seems to be a loss of privacy in that globalism. And it's sort of like, you know, the Empire Strikes Back or something like that, where people are saying, you know, we want to have, you know, privacy, and we don't want to be so centralized. You know, we want to have more diversity. You don't want to be homogenized. Am I getting any of this kind of ethos right?
I take exception to your claim that globalization has been shoved down our throats. I see it as an organic and a beneficial process. It's not without stress. It's not without its not without its problems. And personally, I do not believe that we can have a healthy free trade system unless we also have the gold standard to calibrate the system. But unfortunately, so you've asked a brilliant philosophical question, but we only have about another minute. And this
I'm gonna give my answer to the question. I agree. Globalization is the natural organic interconnectivity of the world. Globalism is the centralized control of economies at the meta level by extraterritorial powers, and no, globalism is what's being crammed down our throat, in my opinion. I, being the populist who wants decentralization, I think there should be a million countries in the world, not 197.
Okay,
that would be fun. So, if we haven't, if you're dissatisfied with the answer, with Bill's answer to your question, as wouldn't be, call back in next week.
Everyone is satisfied with my answer. Thank you. Right, Saul?
I get it. It's, you know, one of you guys, you know, Ralph, you want to have fewer apps, you know, and Bill wants to have more, you know, and I.